I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Hello, this is Mike Swanson, and in a few moments, you're going to listen to another segment of Parallax Views. But before you do that, let me tell you about my new book, Why the Vietnam War. It's a sequel to my previous book called The War State, which has lots of positive reviews and Amazon's been out for years. But this one is a more detailed case study of how American Empire and National Security State operate using Vietnam. And I believe it shows also how things work today, how policy is actually made and why. So grab the book on Amazon.com, Why the Vietnam War.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. On this edition of the program, we'll be discussing the outcome of Iran's presidential election with returning guest and I would say my go-to expert on matters pertaining to U.S.-Iran relations, Dr. Asal Rad of the National Iranian American Council. What exactly does Ibrahim Raisi's victory in the Iranian presidential election mean? Well, for one thing, it has emboldened hardliners in Iran, and it could have implications not only for the Iranian people, but also U.S.-Iran relations. Dr. Sal Rod will discuss all that and much more with us on this edition of the show. And yes, we do talk about the United States federal government's seizure of the Iranian state-sanctioned television website, Press TV. Now, let's get right to the conversation with Dr. Asal Rad of the National Iranian American Council. Welcome back to Parallax Views, a guest that I enjoyed having on last time from the National Iranian American Council, Dr. Asal Rad, who has been very, very busy lately. I think you've done multiple interviews today.
Yeah, I've had, well, one was yesterday. They just posted it today.
Okay. So the reason I wanted to have you back on is because we just had the Iranian elections, and it appears that hardliners have taken power. Could you fill my listeners in case they haven't been paying enough attention to those elections?
Sure. So a few things to keep in mind about the election. First, there's like a hesitancy in calling it an election because of the vetting process that the Guardian Council went through. And just for like a very, very little background, essentially in every election, the Guardian Council chooses which candidates that nominate themselves can or cannot run in that election. And it's always been somewhat of an undemocratic process in the qualifications of what makes them vet these candidates. But in this particular case, it was unprecedented. The people that they had disqualified from running, which I think the one that really shocked most Iranians was the disqualification of former parliamentary speaker Ali Larijani. And the reason is because he's, you know, like a staple of the Iranian government after the revolution, him and his family. So for someone of that level and status to have been disqualified, really shocked Iranians across the board. But even before this sort of process, and like a lot of Iranian observers, that's why they called it, you know, a selection rather than an election. It seemed as if the supreme leader and the hardliner camp that is aligned behind him were really just trying to select the candidate that they wanted that would give them the least amount of resistance. Even before that disqualification process, there was a lot of disillusionment and disaffection among Iranian voters for a combination of reasons. The central reason being their economic woes, right? They exist in economic devastation. And the central reason behind that is the U.S. withdrawing from the Iran nuclear deal and the Trump administration imposing sanctions that Secretary Pompeo at the time said would be, when they were through, the strongest sanctions against any country in history. Of course, there's been increasing repression during this time within the country itself. There's the corruption and mismanagement that exacerbates all of the economic problems that Iranians are having. But there's also just no question to the fact that U.S. sanctions have had this impact, and you really just have to listen to U.S. officials saying it, right? Again, Secretary of State Pompeo at the time boasted about how U.S. sanctions had devalued Iranian currency, had really, you know, hurt Iran's economy. It's just, go ahead.
Not to interrupt you, but the thing that I don't get about the sanction policies is that it seems like it's not punishing the regime, whether it's sanctions in Iran or sanctions in Venezuela. It's just punishing the people living there.
No, you're absolutely right. And that's actually what's interesting is that our stated policy objective is the opposite, right? What we state in terms of when the government takes on this policy is that we're trying to hurt or undermine the Iranian government or any government in these cases. Whereas to your point, it's really just devastating people. You know, one example is a recent report that said something like 10 to 15% of the Iranian middle class over the course of maximum pressure had been forced into poverty. That's millions of people. And what's interesting is to hear these same officials in the U.S. say that they stand with the Iranian people. And in fact, the sanctions are not meant to harm them. But of course, that's what's happening. Worse yet, it's happening during a pandemic. And the sanctions that prevented humanitarian goods and medicines from getting into Iran have not been lifted, even under the Biden administration, not yet.
In regards to what you said earlier about the elections themselves and how people view them, I've heard some people say, well, why should we even talk about the Iranian elections? Isn't the president basically selected by the supreme leader? How would you respond to that? What are people missing when they simplify it to that level?
Well, first of all, the Iranian elections up until this particular election have not gone through this egregious of a disqualification process. So they have been historically competitive and always consequential. And this election will still be consequential. It's just a matter of how much control Iranian people actually had over its results. Now, keep in mind that Iranians did have the ability to vote. They chose not to. The choice is still their agency. It's a political choice not to vote, right? To call for a boycott, to say that we're sitting this one out, you had a minimally 22% less turnout in this election than you had in 2017. Now, if all of those people had shown up to vote, Ebrahim Raisi did not actually gain that many votes in this election between 2021 and 2017. But those people chose not to vote because of, like I said, a multitude of reasons. Also, the responsibility of the reformist and moderate camps to actually fulfill the promises that they had made to Iranian people, feeling like their vote is futile in terms of changing their life situation. So there's all sorts of reasons why they would not participate in this process, but that in and of itself is consequential because that's what helps bring someone like Raisi to power. But it also really gives you a reading on the political situation in the country. But to say that there's no consequence to the election in general, in Iranian elections, if that were the case, then why are so many US headlines talking about it, right? Like, you'll see now people who were opponents of diplomacy to begin with, who, you know, supporters of diplomacy under maximum pressure said all along that by undermining the moderates and the reformists, you're handing a victory over to the hardliners. You're emboldening them. And that's precisely what happened, right? The fear was that exactly what has come to pass would come to pass. Now, if you are a supporter of maximum pressure, this is precisely the result that you wanted.
If you could, for my listeners, who is Ebrahim Raisi and what are the beliefs of people like him and other hardliners?
Well, Ebrahim Raisi has risen through the ranks of the Islamic Republic since after the revolution. None of his positions have been elected positions. He's always been appointed. In the 1980s, he was a prosecutor. He played a central role in mass executions of political prisoners in 1988. This is one of the central human rights violations and abuses that detractors of him rightfully speak about. He also served recently in 2014. He was appointed the head of the Ostan Hots Razavi, which is basically in charge of the, it manages the finances of the Imam Reza Shrine in Mashhad in Iran. It's the holiest site in Iran for Shia Muslims. That was symbolically a very important post to hold, but again, it was an appointed post. And most recently, he also served as the chief judiciary. And under his watch, again, you know, one of the things he did is to carry out a anti-corruption campaign, going after actual corruption in the state. But at the same time, he also oversaw increased repression of activists within Iran as well.
So in regards to his political beliefs, what are they? How would you describe the hardliners in Iran and how they view relations with the U.S.?
I think it's always difficult to sort of take any group and paint them with one brush, right? Even within these ranks, there's going to be people who have differences of opinions, not only on policy, but on how to carry out policy. But looking at Raisi himself, I mean, if you look at his history, and if you especially look at him during the presidential debates, you know, he didn't have much to say about foreign policy issues. It seems as though his focus is on domestic policy issues. But one of the sort of features of the more right-leaning hardliners that we talk about in Iran is that they are less prone to wanting to engage the West or have diplomacy with the United States. This is the camp that still is treating Iran as if it's in a revolution. It's that revolutionary discourse and rhetoric from 1979 still carrying through all these decades later. And so one of the reasons why opponents of maximum pressure said the decision to quit the nuclear deal and impose sanctions is one of the lines the hardliners have repeatedly said is that the U.S. can't be trusted, right? That's part of their regular discourse. The U.S. can't be trusted. Of course, the moderates and the reformists were trying to play their hand at engagement with the West. They wanted to have diplomacy, and that could only be based on a relationship that had trust on both sides, if not friendship, but at least trust to abide by a certain agreement, in this case, the nuclear deal. Of course, the decision to quit the deal, when we say it handed them a victory, that's why, because it really affirmed what they have been saying all along, that the U.S. couldn't be trusted. Now, whether or not that's true or false in terms of the U.S., I mean, administrations in the U.S. are different as well, right? So that was the Trump administration. But of course, I mean, Biden, go ahead.
Real quick, I just wanted to say, I can sort of understand the Iranian perspective on that because, you know, we had the deal under Obama and then Trump just, you know, completely tosses it. Well, okay, Biden can get back in the deal, but then what if 4 years from now we have another sort of Trump-like leader and they just go and toss the deal again? I could see why Iran would say, well, why should we trust the U.S. in this?
Well, you know, what's interesting is one of the things that Iranians have brought up in terms of these new negotiations is the way that the nuclear deal was framed and set up created some kind of, you know, if Iran didn't abide by the deal, then there was a snapback of international sanctions. So there was a way of keeping, of measuring Iran's compliance with the deal and a sort of form of punishment or accountability if they don't. That was not the case for the other parties, right? The assumption was always, well, Iran can't be trusted because that's the U.S. side of the rhetoric, right? On the U.S., the question is always Iran can't be trusted. Of course, once the U.S. pulled out of the deal, there was nothing to hold the U.S. accountable. And so moving forward, I think for Iranians, that will be potentially a sticking point where, you know, what is exactly what you're saying? What is the guarantee that the U.S. will actually abide by this deal? We've already had the precedent of the fact that they haven't. And I think what's also frustrating for Iranians and as Americans, for Biden supporters, for people who, you know, wanted to see a change in foreign policy when they advocated for and voted for Joe Biden, is that we're not seeing that much difference. Yes, there's some nuanced differences. They're not exactly the same. But in terms of foreign policy, for the most part, they are the same. You know, the sanctions that were on Iran that that the Trump administration levied, almost all of them are still in place in terms of the pandemic and essential goods. All of those problems still exist for Iran. So here we are, even in a new administration, and though we're taking, hopefully, these steps towards resolving and coming back into compliance with the deal under the Biden administration, there's still, you know, he could have moved much faster in getting there.
I was going to add to that. I think it's interesting that Biden has essentially said, well, I'm not concerned about foreign policy. I'm more concerned about the domestic policy at home, which by definition, that means, well, you're not going to change the foreign policy. It's probably going to stay as it was during the Trump administration. I think that's what we've sort of seen, at least in the early stages of the presidency so far.
Absolutely. But the key to that is the parts of Trump's foreign policy that Biden himself criticized so strongly when he was a candidate, before he was even a candidate, right? And the central criticism of Biden, of Secretary of State Blinken, all before they were elected, was the Trump administration's policy on Iran as just, you know, a maximum failure. This is how it was described. Biden himself said that it would isolate the United States and not Iran. He said it was a huge mistake. And yet, you know, after condemning Trump for what he saw as a failure of policy vis-a-vis Iran, he hasn't really taken practical steps to reverse it. Because to be completely honest, President Trump was not against negotiations with Iran. That was never his real issue, right? President Trump wanted to basically slap his name on a new deal just to take credit for it. And that was really what he was looking for. But, you know, he repeatedly made overtures that said, you know, let's negotiate a deal. Of course, after assassinating Iran's, you know, the commander of Iran's IRGC Quds force, Qasem Soleimani, that became politically impossible for anyone in Iran to enter into negotiations with someone like Donald Trump. And of course, the other problem that Trump had were the people that were actually around him, right? His own appointees. When you have people like John Bolton and Mike Pompeo, who are outspoken Iran hawks, who have talked about regime change in Iran, who have no problem with going to war in Iran, then that makes his ability to negotiate with them much more difficult. And that's exactly what we saw. But the point being that the fact that the Biden administration is offering negotiations to return to the deal and return to compliance is not a massive break from Trump himself.
In regards to Iran, what does Raisi being president mean for the Iranian people?
My personal opinion, unfortunately for the Iranian people, especially for, you know, it's one thing to keep in mind is, again, Iranian people are well over 80 million people. And so while there was low voter turnout, millions of people still did vote for him. It is not a majority, but a significant portion of the population that supports these very figures and their politics. So it's not all Iranians. But arguably, the majority of Iranians will likely experience more. It's not even that they would experience more repression. It's just that what they probably will not get is the reform, the openness, the engagement with the international community that they were hoping for under the umbrella of the reformist movement or reformists or moderates or whatever you want to call them. Right. So it's about what they're likely not going to get. But at the same time, Raisi has signaled the fact that he would not oppose returning to the nuclear deal, because this was something even before this election, this was something that even under the Rouhani administration, there was a national consensus in the national security field in the country that they would join the nuclear deal, that they would abide by the deal. So at least hopefully Iranians will see some sanctions relief, some economic relief, and, you know, just hopefully the ability to be able to secure their livelihoods, their have access to essential goods, be able to, you know, get a job and pay for foods and medicines. I mean, those are as basic as aspirations can be.
It's interesting to me. I've seen two reports that stood out to me, one in USA Today about how Raisi apparently said after his epic election win, I think that's a quote, that he won't be meeting with President Biden. And then I also saw something from Newsweek, actually, about John Bolton blasting Biden over his dangerous fantasy of getting back into the Iran deal. It seems like, in a way, Raisi's victory, it emboldens both hardliners and these really hawkish figures like John Bolton, that I think it's just going to cause more deterioration of relations between the U.S. and Iran.
And that's exactly why I said at the beginning that the people who were always opposed to, I mean, there's a piece by Elliot Abrams, I believe it's in Politico from 2017. And Abrams, obviously famously known for his role in the Iran-Contra affair in the 1980s. And then late in the Trump administration, he replaced Brian Hook as the Iran envoy. And you have Abrams write a piece in 2017 hoping that Raisi wins that election in 2017. So it's 100% connected, right? These hawks, these people who do not want and never wanted diplomatic relations with Iran, have found every excuse they possibly can to undermine any type of diplomatic efforts. And so having someone like Raisi benefits them. It benefits, you know, hardliners in Iran and the US are aligned in the fact that they, to a certain extent, oppose diplomacy. The only difference being that Raisi, again, will likely, Iran will likely return to compliance into the deal, as will the United States. But where, you know, under different circumstances, the JCPOA could have been a sort of foundation to build on, right? To build more diplomacy, to address the regional issues and conflicts that really, the United States needs Iran's cooperation because whether or not we like it, it is a regional power. Instead of building on it, what this administration will likely do is the JCPOA will be the ceiling. That'll be as far as we'll go with diplomacy.
Now, we also have a new prime minister in Israel now, Naftali Bennett. How do you think that will affect international relations? I mean, just between the U.S., Iran, and Israel, because he also is kind of an ultra-conservative.
Well, I mean, you see this trend to a certain extent of a movement towards not just the right. When you see a movement towards the right, you also see a rise in people moving towards the left. And that's sort of a consequence of global policies. There's a reason why you're seeing it on such a large scale in so many different countries. And we don't have to get into this, but one of the central reasons is just mass global inequality, right? Like, this is why people move away from the center, because the center is not helping them. And in the case of Naftali Bennett, I mean, it's fascinating. People who sort of were excited that Netanyahu was out of the picture. I mean, Netanyahu is I am not favorable of him as a figure, obviously, but Naftali Bennett is in many ways worse. He's more ideologically bound. I mean, it was interesting. I think he had a comment about the election of Raisi, something, I'm paraphrasing, but something like, you know, the fact that someone like him rose to power is an indication of the fact that Iran should not be trusted with, say, like weapons of mass destruction.
He said something. He called it a wake up.
Yes, a wake up. That was the phrase. And I just thought that statement was seeped in irony. I was like, well, number one, Iran doesn't have weapons of mass destruction. Israel does. Israel has a nuclear weapons arsenal that no one talks about and everybody pretends doesn't exist. And he is someone, I mean, people sort of famously quote him as saying, you know, I've killed Arabs and there's nothing wrong with that. And he supports racist policies. It's been 1 week that he's been prime minister of Israel, and we've already seen two cases of bombings in Gaza. I mean, the issue of these sort of international actors talking at each other in this fashion is that none of them have a sense of irony, right? Like, and Raisi will now use the same rhetoric against Israel and against Bennett with having no sense of irony for his own, you know, abuses of his own people or anything like that. But that's where the international community comes in, right? The international community is supposed to be above these sort of domestic quibbles, right? It's supposed to be a law that's shared across the land that everybody is supposed to abide by, that nobody is above or an exception to. And unfortunately, that's not what happens either. The case in point, what I just said, Iran and Israel are two countries in the Middle East, one of which has nuclear weapons that nobody ever talks about, the other of which has no nuclear weapons and its people are sanctioned into poverty. So there's a clear double standard when we look at the way that we approach policy about these countries.
Yeah, it's been interesting. I thought it was telling that immediately after that news report came out saying that Raisi didn't really want to meet with Biden, the next day we have news coming out now, just hours ago, I think, that the U.S. federal government has seized the Press TV website. For people that don't know, Press TV is an Iranian state media outlet. I don't think that was necessarily a good move on the U.S.'s part. I just wanted to get your take on it, though.
To your point, it is a fresh story. And so I don't think we have all of the details. I believe state spokesperson Ned Price was actually asked about it and said that they would not comment on it right now. The story, according to Associated Press, the circumstances are unclear behind the fact that they've seized these websites. I mean, you know, there's all sorts of things that you can say about it, right? Press TV is a state news broadcast of Iran. And, you know, if the argument is, for instance, that it spreads disinformation, well, so does Fox News. But we don't do anything to censor Fox News. There's all sorts of discussions and debates we can get into in terms of why they would seize that website. And we don't know what they're going to do about it. But I think ultimately, again, it creates a situation where all we're doing is isolating Iran further and further. And what it really betrays is the people that we claim to stand with, right? I mean, Iranian people do not want to be isolated. They want to be engaged. They want openness. They don't want to continuously suffer. Because again, a website going down just allows the Iranian government to pursue what it's wanted to pursue, which is basically having its own internet and completely closing the country off. So we're facilitating that. And I think that's where there's a disconnect between our policies and our stated objectives. Whatever it is in this particular case, I don't know.
I just wanted to add to that. I think it's not an issue of whether we like Press TV or we like Raisi, because I have a lot of criticisms of something like Press TV and Raisi. But, absolutely. You know, some of these policies can have really bad consequences.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's the same thing. It's not a question of whether or not you – and it's difficult sometimes to – there's certain debates within the U.S., foreign policy debates especially, that are quite toxic, right? And debating Iran is a very difficult thing to do, because sometimes people will take exactly that, you know, the approach of if you criticize a move by the United States, then that means, you know, you're endorsing Press TV. No, you're not. Like, that has nothing to do with it. You can absolutely be critical of two things simultaneously. And so, you know, on one hand, yes, Press TV can be easily criticized. But on the other hand, you know, like, again, what is the intention of this move? To me, it looks like whatever the intention is behind it, you just create more isolation. And that typically has hurt the Iranian people rather than the Iranian government, especially its hardline elements, who would like nothing more than to be completely isolated. And that is one of the approaches that someone like Raisi will take, right? An economy of resistance, a national economy, a national internet, everything that just turns Iran inwards onto itself and doesn't require it to rely on really anyone, but especially on Western powers.
Now, before closing out, I guess when it comes to the JCPOA, why should Americans still be concerned about getting back into the deal? Because we're going to hear a lot of, I think, propaganda now. I don't know another word to use other than that, from the sort of John Bolton types that are going to say, oh, see, this is why we can't renew the deal. How would you respond to that?
I think sometimes people have completely lost sight of what the deal is about. Like, what is the purpose of the deal? There's a reason why it's called the Iran nuclear deal. What the deal should really have been, which unfortunately, because of everything that happened with the Trump administration, we have not been able to do, is a model for nuclear non-proliferation and diplomacy and global diplomacy that we could build on. Because essentially, look, as a global community, we are facing problems that require global cooperation. I mean, it's a little on the nose that we were just in a pandemic, and this should be extremely obvious that there are problems that we will face that we have to tackle together with cooperation. And so on one hand, the deal just gave you that. You have the United States and Iran, two longtime adversaries who were able to resolve a conflict without war, right? Like that was supposed to, that's one of the biggest benefits of the deal. But of course, the main purpose of the deal was to have oversight over Iran's civilian nuclear program to ensure that they couldn't make a nuclear weapon. And this was, you know, proliferation experts, or I should say non-proliferation experts, have said that it was the strongest non-proliferation agreement in history, that it has existed. I mean, it is a model to build on. It's something that should, you know, there are, I think it was the New York Times editorial board said something about, you know, what we should build on is from the Iran nuclear deal is creating a nuclear-free zone. Now, it said a nuclear-free zone in the Persian Gulf. And what's fascinating about the New York Times editorial is that it admitted Israel's nuclear weapons, but then said those are non-negotiable. And of course, that's not a nuclear-free zone in a region. That's just one country having an advanced military advantage and depriving it of every other country. And so that's, again, it goes back to the problem. If we're not treating countries equally, if we're not understanding the global implications of, you know, global security, then we're really undermining our own security in that process. So the deal was about preventing Iran from getting a weapon. And for Iran itself, the secondary the benefits to that, I should say, were economic relief. And that helps Iranian people. So there is a humanitarian element to this as well. Everything else I've said is just practical, logical, and affects like Americans in terms of their own security. But the humanitarian aspect of the deal is if we actually, you know, we talk about human rights, but if we actually care about human rights, then we don't implement policies that hurt ordinary people. And that's what sanctions have done. So that's, you know, a secondary benefit to the deal itself is that we're not actually actively harming people.
There was just two more questions I had, and then I'll let you go because I know you're very busy. The first one, though, I had is, you know, since I mentioned John Bolton before, I hear a lot of people these days saying, well, these characters like Bolton don't matter. They're leftovers from the Bush era. You know, the neocons don't have that much power anymore. And the U.S. isn't in a position to get into a real, you know, violent conflict with any given country, even Iran. And I feel like people are underestimating how one false move in geopolitics can lead to, you know, really deleterious, you know, incidents. So I wanted to get your take on that.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. And there's absolutely no, there's no logic to that statement, right? It's more wishful thinking than anything else. And if you want a historical example, I'll just give you one that's incredibly simple. World War I was called the war to end all wars until World War II happened, right? So there's this concept that we've historically had that just says, oh, well, you know, don't take it seriously just because something sounds incredibly stupid to us, because it does, right? I mean, you made the point that part of the argument is the U.S. really doesn't have the capacity to take on, you know, another sort of large conflict. I mean, if we're looking at Afghanistan and Iraq as massive failures, Iran is not even in the same realm. Iran is a much bigger challenge than either of those. So do we have the capacity to take it on? And do we have the will within our population to take it on? The answer is no on both accounts, especially when it comes to the will of the American people and whether or not, you know, our government particularly cares about the will of their own people. But that doesn't mean that it's an impossibility. And that's why we have to hold our officials accountable. If we sort of, you know, relinquish control and say, and aren't concerned about the patterns that we're seeing, then very easily, yes, one miscalculation can lead us to a much larger conflict. And I'll go back to the example of World War I. You know, World War I was sparked by the assassination of one person. So you don't know. The problem with larger conflicts is that they're not always as predictable as the invasion of Iraq in 2003, where we, you know, set up a whole show to tell everybody that we're going to invade the country. Sometimes the conflicts arise without our control over it. And so I would definitely not, I would take people like John Bolton their threats, I should say, seriously, because, you know, he's still getting featured in papers like Wall Street Journal. I mean,
Robert Kagan is still writing in Foreign Affairs, you know.
We're still talking about them. So if they were really irrelevant, then there would be no need to talk about them. They continue to be relevant, not because I think the arguments they make are relevant, but because they sort of force themselves in those positions.
And the last question I had was, do you think we're eventually, and I'm not saying this is going to happen soon, because I think it's really hard to sort of penetrate the DC beltway or the DC foreign policy blob, but do you think we're at least starting to see maybe signs for cautious optimism? For instance, I think when it comes to Israel and Palestine, we've seen sort of a sea change in how portions of the populace view that issue. Do you think we're seeing sea changes potentially in the future when it comes to U.S. foreign policy?
Well, I'm a little biased because I'm always cautiously optimistic, right? I just don't see any point in sort of deciding that there's nothing that we can do about it. I don't think that that's the case. I do think that there's certainly indications. You pointed to the discussion of Israel-Palestine. This last series of attacks in Gaza really, and this is from activists, people who have been working on Palestine, Palestinians themselves, for decades. And the significant difference that they noted wasn't the policy, wasn't what happened. It was how people talked about it. It was the conversations that were being had. And there's polling to support that as well, right? There's a shift happening. There's a generational shift, especially in how Americans are viewing foreign policy. And you know, we saw the early stages of that with the war on terror and the invasion of Iraq, and the fact that now you have bipartisan support against endless wars. There was I believe it was a YouGov poll at the end of February that polled Biden voters and Trump voters from this last election, and both groups, the majority supported direct negotiations with Iran to resolve the nuclear issue, right? It was 54% of Trump supporters and 84% of Biden voters. So there is a majority support in the country that they want to change the way that we approach foreign policy. And I think it also plays into domestic issues, right? The fact that our domestic politics have moved towards this idea of, well, how is our government spending our tax dollars? Do we really want $2 billion a day spent on wars that have seemingly given us as Americans nothing, when Americans themselves are in many ways suffering? And those are the things that we rarely talk about, right? We don't talk about the fact that there are 40 million Americans that live in poverty. And this is how our tax dollars are being spent on aiding, you know, occupation and apartheid in Israel and on fruitless wars. And so I think that there's a whole shift in the way that Americans are talking about these policies. And that makes me, yes, cautiously optimistic.
I was just going to add to that very briefly here. I think on one end, you have progressives that say, well, you know, if we want universal single payer health care, then, you know, we can't have all this money going to the Pentagon budget. And I think with conservatives that are becoming more cautious of war, I mean, we look at the war on terror. I think it was very destabilizing to society. And I mean, if you're philosophically conservative, right, you don't want the sort of order to be destabilized. So I think there is sort of a bipartisan consensus among portions of the population about this.
Absolutely. There absolutely is. And that's why candidates and presidents, whether they're Democrat or Republican, you see it in Biden, you saw it in Trump, both talk about ending endless wars. Like, that has just become a catchphrase for everyone, because that's definitely what the American populace wants.
So how can my listeners keep up with your work? And I want to thank you again for coming on the show. You're one of the most articulate guests I have on, and I'm always pleased to speak with you.
Thank you. That is very kind. And I'm always happy to join and chat about these things. You can follow me on Twitter at AssalRad. That's the whole Twitter handle, AssalRad. I give all these little sound bites on Twitter, so feel free to follow me there.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Dr. AssalRad of the National Iranian American Council. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at @ViewsParallax or by email at parallaxviewspod@protonmail.com. Producers credit shoutouts to Catherine, Nathan, Holland, Mark, Chase, Zach, Omar, Ted, Brian, Gratz, Martin, Gary, Emilia, and Mickey. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well, consider joining those listeners in supporting me at the $10 or $15 tiers of my Patreon page at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. There is also a $1 tier and a $5 tier. Any amount will help. Your support is what keeps this show going. So if you appreciate the work I do, $1, $5, $10, $15, doesn't matter. Please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. Again, that's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxieties, problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.